Paul's letter to the Romans includes some fairly difficult language about the ruling authorities. Be submissive, he says, for they are not a danger to good behavior, but only to bad. Well, he seems a little naive as we look out over the history that has unfolded since the days he wrote. Jesus' way seems more sober-minded. Here, in some of Jesus' words, we could say, conflict is awful. Conflict is normal. Conflict is not going away. Until heaven and earth pass away, conflict is how we go, and conflict is how we grow. Such seems to be the worldview of Jesus of Nazareth. The apostle also is aware of it. But we will spend our energies with Jesus today. For there, in his words, there is no victory on earth. There is no perfect peace. It is not thy will be done, but a fight. The revelation to John certainly contemplates a total victory for the armies of Jesus, but it is bought with such wrath and violence that we should make no apology for keeping that wild dream at the back of the book. The heart of our scriptures beats very differently. Here, human powers are real and divided. Here, you will be struck on the right cheek. Here, they will take your coat. Here, they will force you to bear their burdens. There will be enemies. And you are commanded to love them. Religion, conceived as lovely feelings governing our common life, seems sentimental set alongside Jesus. Why, he was executed, for God's sake. In this world, conflict is the way. Here, we must fight. Today, we're opening a series of sermons which aims to connect our faith in Christ with the fights of our times. We're going to be doing this every Sunday, starting in July, right on into the fall. I'm going to be gathering those who have the inclination, the time, the desire to share their wisdom. I'm going to be gathering the congregation on Wednesday evenings before Space for Grace, starting at about 5:30, to look at particular issues together with me. They'll be identified in our communications media which issue is for consideration on which Wednesday, and these will be correlated with the sermon that will follow in 10 days thereafter. The kinds of things we'll struggle with are those conflicts around which no moral or political will has formed yet for decision and solution of vast injustices that we face. Now, I do not aim to define what a Christian must believe. Goodness knows, I wouldn't go there. However, I do want to claim that your commitment to Christ must become concrete as a way of seeing, a way of seeing that leads you to decision, a way of seeing that requires a stand be taken in the great matters of our day. It is my hope that you will, in a word, accept your struggle, that we learn how to fight. This word decision, you know, it's a word cousin with all the other scission words, precision, incision, concision. They all have to do with cutting. In the case of decision, the cutting is cutting off debate. Time to stop going to and fro, wondering where to commit. Time to make a commitment. Time to decide who you are and whose you are and what you're going to do. And our sermon series will be about the matters where decisions like that are needed. I hope these sermons may help us to stand in the urgency of James Russell Lowell's great poem, feeling that once to every man and nation comes the moment to decide in the strife of truth with falsehood, for the good or evil side. But in order to get there, we've got to get complex. The churches that fill with the thousands and the tens of thousands, one of the ways they do it is they don't get complex. Easy religion makes for very popular religion in this country, just like easy bumper sticker politics makes for popular politics. When we go down in a few levels, people peel off. Understand. But let's ask, why must we fight? Can't we all just get along? As that badly battered Rodney King plaintively put it 20 years ago, and the answer is no, we cannot. That is the first word we need in coming to an adequate theory of what makes humans tick. No, we cannot just all get along. The Marxists are wrong. Let's be plain spoken here. They're wrong in their reading of human nature. For no peace is coming after the powerful and the rich are laid low by violence. No, that's not how we work or think or behave. The free market capitalists, they're wrong in their reading of human nature. How bizarre they are, honestly, claiming innocence and pure motives, refusing regulations of their war-making and their money-making because they assure us they can be trusted with to govern themselves. Ha! Self-government is the very thing they abandoned when they decided to pursue the prizes of the world. Religious idealists are also wrong. They also misread human nature if they suppose that peace will burst forth from mere peacefulness. We're not in that world. These false theories of human relations are motivated by desires which those who hold them don't even seem to understand about themselves. Just before Hitler came on history's scene, 80 years ago, Reinhold Niebuhr published the book Moral Man and Immoral Society. Here on page 2 of that great book, he jumps on the question, why we must fight. I read, "While it is possible for intelligence to increase the range of benevolent impulses and thus prompt human beings to consider the needs and rights of others than those to whom they are bound by close relationship, there are definite limits in the capacity of ordinary mortals which make it impossible for them to grant to others what they claim for themselves. All social cooperation on a larger scale than the most intimate social group requires a measure of coercion." Oh, Reinhold Niebuhr was a sober-minded man. Sober about sin, though he does not much use that term. He speaks rather, you heard it, of definite limits in the capacity of ordinary mortals to care about other people. Sin, for short. Definite limits. And thus, he goes on to argue, while moral ideals advanced by the religions can and do motivate individuals in their close relationships to what he calls the benevolent impulse, larger societies cannot function morally. That is the judgment of this book, so powerfully argued. Larger societies cannot function morally. They can only function in terms of group interests, politics by another name. An individual may indeed grow toward the ideal of self-sacrifice, but no group can aim at group sacrifice as its goal. That would be unjust. So it is that justice is the ideal for the group and love for the individual, the basic claims of this extraordinary volume. Niebuhr presses on. The power to coerce is necessary for larger groups, and the power to coerce always overreaches. I read some more. All through history, one may observe the tendency of power to destroy its very raison d'etre, its very purpose for being. Power is suffered by the populace because it achieves internal unity and creates external defenses for the nation, but power grows to such proportions that it destroys the social peace of the state by the animosities which it arouses, and it enervates the sentiment of patriotism by robbing the common people of the basic privileges which might bind them to their nation. Do we not see this underway in our own? Do we not see it underway here in our own city, where so many are robbed of the rights of privacy and the rights of their own protection of their body? The Fourth Amendment be damned by the stop-and-frisk policy of the city. It is for these reasons that we fight. We must fight. We must fight for what is right, and this principle is already plain in the scriptures. The question is how to fight. Just like the animals? I'm calling this series of sermons Wings of the Dove, to remind me of something that I forget all the time, to ground my thought in a strange requirement of love, of Christian love. It is needful even in the realm of law, if we can listen to Romans 13 in its final sentence. For only love is the fulfillment of the law. The requirement, the strange requirement, is this. We need the other wing. You with me? We need the other wing. So ordinary to our speech, in America at least, are the words right wing and left wing. So beloved of Americans is the eagle, if not the dove. It seems odd to me that we never notice that our core metaphor, the eagle, wants two wings, not one, or one. The other day I heard Rick Santorum bloviating to the Chicago gathering of the Conservative Political Action Committee, CPAC. He was gloating over the big happening in Wisconsin from 10 days ago or so. And he was saying, there's one big difference between conservatives and our opponents. We are right and they are wrong. Oh, he's so clear. What a silly man. There's only one affirmation Mr. Santorum calls himself Christian. He's a Christian. There's only one affirmation that is complex enough for disciples of the Master. We are one body with two wings. If you want to fly, don't cut, don't clip the other wing. Haven't you seen a great bird made prisoner by its master who had but to scissor off a little bit of feathers of one wing to keep that creature's beauty for himself by destroying its flight? Haven't you seen that done? If you want to fly, oh people, do your thing. Pray for your enemies and swing your wing hard. That is how we must fight. Now, early in May, one of the great swingers of the wing, Professor Walter Wink, formerly of Union Seminary, formerly, I should say, late of Auburn Seminary, where he ultimately preferred to teach. He died in May, and his life was celebrated yesterday in James Chapel. I wasn't able to be there, but I did meditate on Walter Wink's teachings yesterday. I first studied with Walter and June Keener Wink in the 1980s at the Stony Point Center, actually. It was an Auburn program when they used to be held up at Stony Point. Having abandoned as bankrupt his word, the biblical critical method called the higher criticism, he was now Transforming Bible Study, name of one of his books. Nice little pun there, Transforming Bible Study. And his commitment was to engage with the text in so basic a way that one might confront there the person of Jesus and be brought to a decision like Jesus' decision. After June Keener Wink had brought us through a movement exercise, let our mind not be stuck in the head, but come inside our body, they shared that commitment that June would always teach with Walter. So after the movement exercises, Walter read one morning so long ago, "If anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn," and then would interrupt him. He would interrupt his own reading mid-sentence in this too well-known passage. There was something else to be discovered here. He would invite one of us up to stand in front of him, and he would say, "Okay, strike me on the right cheek." And inevitably, it was his left cheek that we ended up aiming for. Now, this isn't really very nice, but turn to your neighbor and strike her or him on the... Assuming you're right-handed, you will find, as we found in our Bible study with Walter Wink, it's just about impossible to strike a person on the right cheek. And so, in the midst of the effort where we were going in like this for the left, he would say, "Wait a minute, that's not what Jesus said. He said, when someone strikes you on the right cheek, try it." He would say, "Try, come on, try." And so we'd make an effort and, you know, a silly glancing blow. And then finally, we'd realize the only way to do it is backhanded. Boom. And then Walter would pounce. The backhanded slap is the assault of a superior who intends to humiliate you more than hurt you. And Walter would go on, "Jesus is saying, when they try to humiliate you, don't be humiliated. Show them some cheek. Show them some left cheek. Invite them to fight you as an equal." We must fight. This is how we fight. Always wise as serpents, gentle as doves. Wink was teaching these things. Never give in to rule or to be ruled by fear or force, which he called the domination system in his extraordinary writings. You could go read the rest of Wink on this passage from Matthew about walking the extra mile, about giving up your underwear as well as your coat, and you will feel therein the guidance of militant nonviolence. It's in Transforming Bible Study. There you will find wisdom for why we must fight and how. Now, in my reading, Walter Wink is as sober-minded about sin as Reinhold Niebuhr. Here's a quote. "The struggle against evil," this is Wink, "the struggle against evil can make us evil. And no amount of good intentions automatically prevents that from happening." Niebuhr could have said it. But just here where Niebuhr's counsel becomes thoroughly political, where his admiration for the religious impulse becomes almost wistful, Wink doubles down for the fight. He continues, "The whole armor of God that Ephesians 6 counsels we put on, the whole armor is crafted specifically to protect us against the contagion of evil within our own souls, and its metals are all forged in prayer. Blessed be the life and witness of Walter Wink." Perhaps it is so that all that has been revealed to history in the 80 years since Reinhold Niebuhr wrote his book, such tragic images come to us, the Holocaust, the Second World War, the evils within our own nation of wars against the Vietnamese, against Iraq, mass incarceration, unstopped in our own nation, and beautiful hopes, Gandhi's truth, King's dream, the Obama hope. Perhaps all of that not available to Reinhold Niebuhr in 1932. Perhaps these things are renewing for some of us the sense for what Niebuhr could only call a sublime madness in the soul, which yet holds to the very valuable illusion of perfect realization of justice. Niebuhr's words. Wink seems to be ready for the fight. This, I believe, as surely as history has shown again and again that power so deranges the minds and desires of the powerful that they finally do destroy the very systems which feed their appetites, just so surely is America in for some hard times. Power is at a peak of growth and satisfactions. And power concedes nothing without a demand. Frederick Douglass, as you know, said that. Therefore, when we fight for what is right, in the hope that so great a disaster will not befall all, we are fighting for all, for the whole bird, even though they don't need it, don't believe it, deny it. We are fighting for the whole bird, as are no others. Therefore, you who are training in self-government, which is always both an inward and spiritual training and a political and social training. You who are training in self-government, you who understand that your own appetites are strong and could overwhelm you, and that you are therefore in want of true government. You who desire mastery from the master and who are able to see the whole body, the dove and the eagle on the wing, and you who know to pray for the whole, even as you swing your wing forward in action. You are the ones who will give birth to this troubled nation, a new birth. You are the ones with courage for the times. You are the ones who know why we must fight and how. Amen.